Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Join me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, John.
And expected to join us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And we also expect to hear from Nelson Siegelman. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll start with the shutdown, the partial federal government shutdown, I guess they're calling it, and a lot of reporting around the impact here on Cape Cod this week.
Well, there's the obvious ones that have been happening, and that is that the National Seashore is shut down. We have the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. They have a little aquarium down here in Woods Hole that's shut down, and their people have been furloughed from NOAA. And you know, we're seeing some civilian people who they estimate in terms of the state about 4,600 people are being who are paid by the federal government who have been furloughed in this in the state. But those are the things we see. There are other things that aren't as obvious, like people, like I said, who have been furloughed and are taking a vacation without pay.
Well, speaking of vacations, it was a great story in the paper, well, not great, but a well-reported story, interesting story about some lodgers at a motel out in the seashore. The seashore is really a, kind of an interesting place, the National Seashore, because you if they close it down and you have a business that's been inside the property that's been leased for years and years, you got to close that down too. And that's what's happened with this motel.
Right. This is the Nauset Knoll Motor Lodge, which has been in operation since 1964. And this is the first time that they've had to shut down because of a federal government shutdown. They are a concession within the seashore. And people on Tuesday who were staying there were given 48 hours to find other accommodations because they had to shut down the business.
There was a wonderful quote by one of the vacationers, and she said, "It's a little disappointing to have your vacation interrupted by a hissy fit."
Right. Well, you know, this seems to be happening all over. I heard a story, in fact, on NPR about a guy who had waited 18 years to be able to take a ride, some type of private or individual ride through the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And it spent like $36,000 on equipment and can't get in. And that we're seeing the same thing. This visitor center at the National Seashore gets something like, 10 buses or upwards of 15 buses a day during this season. And people can't get in, often just to use the bathroom, but to look around as well. And there's people from, I know we talked to people from Oakland, California, from parts of Ohio, who are saying, this is our one vacation and we were really looking forward to this. And now we can't get in to see the things that we had hoped to see.
We heard from I believe it was a librarian on Martha's Vineyard who talked about she was about to leave the next day on a vacation to visit more than half a dozen national parks around the country, her dream vacation, and she was distraught over the fact she wasn't going to be able to do that, to get in.
Right. And what the Park Service is saying is that we need people there to monitor what's going on, because when people aren't monitoring, there could be damage to property and other, types of shenanigans going on. So that's why they have to close them. And, the Monomoy Refuge is also closed down there. And so a lot of vacations are being interrupted. And in terms of the fallout from that, that's another thing that's a little less visible is all the people, if those buses are going to the National Seashore, they're going to stop and eat lunch somewhere.
Right.
They may stop and buy tchotchkes or T-shirts. Those are the things that or businesses who are in areas that like maybe some of the we haven't checked with restaurants here. But for example, if there's a number of federal employees who might eat lunch in town, those people are gone and aren't going to be doing that. So there's a fallout to local business as well.
Sure. You can't really quantify how much this is costing the economy based on only on people's salaries. You have to look at the ripple effect across the region.
Right.
The parks, I understand it's if you've got a vacation plan, that's a big deal. But there was a story about a gentleman named Leo Finn from Buzzards Bay in the paper. And this is serious stuff. This is life and death stuff. Tell us about Leo Finn.
Well, Leo Finn was diagnosed with a very rare form of bile duct cancer, liver cancer in the bile ducts. And the chemotherapy was not working for him. So his doctor told him about this experimental drug that seemed to be helping with liver tumors. And at this point, it had been approved by the FDA for aggressive forms of thyroid cancer, but it was in trials now to see if it was effective against liver cancers. And in order to be part of a trial, the FDA has to sign off on the trial that it's going to be up at the Dana-Farber. Well, you know, he thought this was, here's some hope for me. And on Tuesday, he heard from his doctor that because the people at the FDA who sign off on these trials were considered non-essential and had not signed the paperwork in time, they were not going to be able to go forward with the test. He was supposed to start the treatment October 9th, but he had to go through a few tests prior to that. And in addition, he had to be off chemo for a month. So he was at that point faced with either going back on the chemo, which was not effective, which could delay when the government opens up again, his getting that treatment.
So he's left trying to decide, should I go back on chemo to try to stop this cancer, or should I wait it out, hope that some sanity will return to Washington and they'll open things again and we can get into on this trial soon?
Right. Well, a lot of people in Bourne have been supporting Leo and his family, raising money. They've got wristbands, green wristbands that they've been wearing in support of him. They took to social media on Tuesday and Wednesday morning, and it really started to gain some steam. I think that's how George Brennan discovered the story and sat down and talked with him. And I think he was on CNN even yesterday.
Well, George did a fine job on the story. It's a very interesting story. Go ahead.
Well, and it turns out also, just as another, this wasn't just affecting Mr. Finn. It turns out that there were a group of kids in another state, I don't know which state, that couldn't get into their trial. So there, it was happening all over the country. But, you know, people started calling Congressman Keating, who actually lives in Bourne, and he, you know, told George Brennan on Tuesday that I'm going to look for a solution till I can't find one. And yesterday morning, it turns out that they were able to get the FDA to declare these people who do this job as essential workers, and they were able to get them back on the payroll and back to work, and that cleared the way for Mr. Finn and the other people in the situation to get the treatment approved.
Well, it certainly you got to say a positive thing about Congressman Keating for getting involved and helping make that happen, but at the same time, it also shows the power of the local media when they do these types of stories and let people know the consequences of this political action down in Washington.
Well, I think we take for granted some of the ways of government. Now, I'm not arguing that we should have big government or small government. I'm just saying that I think that when things like this happen, you start understanding just how much the government is a part of our lives. Mm-hmm. Now, it's another discussion, like I said, of whether that's good or bad. But it's clearly here was a way that, in very human terms, just like the people who have now had to go without pay, 800,000 people who may or may not be able to afford it. It's the human side of what this, as you said, what, you know, is going on in Washington and lack of ability to come to any kind of agreement that would get this government moving forward.
Let's talk about the other big story out of Washington, though it's certainly a national story. The healthcare signups began this week, which was, of course, the impetus behind the government shutdown.
Right. They shut down on Monday night. And on Tuesday, the Affordable Care Act health insurance exchanges opened. And in Massachusetts, we have had health care for about a decade, I think, universal health care. But there are people who still are not covered. And while the insurance coverage rate in Massachusetts, I believe, is the lowest, with about 96%+ people with insurance, on Cape Cod, 15% of the people here do not have health insurance. So there's a move to help people on the Cape and throughout the state to enter these insurance exchanges and to purchase insurance, which, by the way, is more heavily subsidized under the federal plan than it is under the state plan. Under state law, a family of four would get subsidized insurance at $70,000 a year income. Under the federal law, subsidies go to families making up, families of four making up to $90,000 a year.
So if folks are making up to $90,000 a year, family of four or smaller, they should look into getting something subsidized, at least.
Well, they will get a subsidized plan of, you know, there's different levels. There's the bronze, silver, and platinum. Each one has different mixes of your premium plus out-of-pocket expenses that you would pay. There's a number of choices. In Massachusetts, though, if you're already on a subsidized plan, you have to go re-sign up because they've changed the names of these plans.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me. So there's a dozen plans in Massachusetts that are just simply being renamed.
Right.
So you've got, what, 150,000 people who have to go and sign up again?
Well, probably it has something to do with the different level of subsidies that are available because there's a higher level of subsidies. But if you are trying to... If you want information about it, the Community Action Committee, which is on 372 North Street in Hyannis, is the so-called navigator. These are people who have been trained in the Affordable Care Act and how to sign people up. They've been in areas like they were at the Falmouth Service Center earlier this week on Tuesday. And if you're trying to figure out whether you know, what kind of insurance you need help signing up, you can go to the Community Action Committee or you can call them at 508-771-1727.
And there was also some reporting on the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. They've actually been commended for their work around Obamacare or the Health Care Act.
Right. Well, they had some money from the federal government to help them with these navigation-type services, and the money ran out. So they decided that we're going to just pay the people ourselves to help get people signed up for this health insurance. And so that's why they were commended for, going, still being there and helping people, regardless of whether they had the finance, were getting reimbursed by the federal government to do so.
Let's move on to the nuclear power plant that is located in Plymouth, the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant or Nuclear Power Station. A lot of discussion in recent, years about the lack of a escape plan for people who live on Cape Cod. More discussion about that based on a new survey.
Right. Well, this is a survey that was paid for by Entergy, which is the owner of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. There's been a lot of pressure over, for, 20 or 30 years to get Cape Cod included in the evacuation planning should there be a radiological emergency at the plant. And this survey was released about a month ago.
Yep.
And one of the things that had always been kind of the common wisdom, federally, the nuclear power plants are required to plan for evacuation on a 10-mile radius of the plant. We're in a unique kind of location because the Cape winds around, goes back up north, and is directly across in some places from the plant. But we are not in that 10-mile radius, but could be affected by a radiological emergency. So the common wisdom was, well, Cape Codders would stay in place. Well, this survey that was done showed that more than half of the people would not stay in place. They would take off. If there was an emergency, they would try to get off Cape Cod, which would be a huge issue. But it also said that about 70% of the 500 Cape survey respondents, actually, they said they would evacuate if they were told there was a plan. But about 50% said that they were unaware that they lived beyond the evacuation area mandated by the government. And what the emergency management officials that are saying on Cape Cod at this meeting, a task force meeting held earlier this week, was there is no plan.
Right.
Not only do Cape Cod people not know what they're supposed to do or how they're affected, there's no plan. We do have plans in place for if there's a big snowstorm. As you know, last winter we saw the shelters going up and different things. But there is no plan for a radiologic emergency, and they're saying there really needs to be one.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow that story, I'm sure. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about Chatham Airport. We'll also talk about tick-borne diseases on Nantucket. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hey, Sean.
A lot of discussion in recent weeks about the Chatham Airport and mostly about the skydiving operation there. Now there's some information on the economic impact of the airport.
Yeah, we have a story this week about a 2011 study that the state did on the economic impact of small airports around the state. And part of it does focus on Chatham, and it found that Chatham Airport generated about almost $13 million annually in economic activity. Now, that involves both economic activity at the airport as well as extrapolated out into the community. Basically, they found that the airport supports about 144 jobs both at the airport and around town, and with a payroll of about $4 million. And interesting statistic is that about 12,000 visitors come into town every season through the airport. And using a number of economic standard figures, they figured that about those people spend about $400 each per trip. So that's how they reach those figures.
Hmm.
Some of the opponents of the airport don't feel that those figures are accurate. They think that they're figures that are applied sort of generally and broadly, and they may not apply to Chatham. We may hear some of this coming up on Tuesday when the Board of Selectmen is going to hear from residents, chiefly about the skydiving issue, but I'm sure some of the economic conditions will also come into that discussion.
So this information is, it's a 2011 study, but the information is coming out in the context of this bigger debate about the skydiving operation? Is that right?
It's come out now, I think, because there's more focus on the airport. When that study was done, it wasn't very well publicized, at least around here.
Yeah.
We found out about it through various channels and were able to obtain a copy of it. I think the airport commission is trying to sort of shine a light on the more positive aspects of the airport, given the negative publicity they've received about the skydiving issue.
Now, you use the phrase opponents of the airport. Has that what it's evolved into out there in Chatham? Is it no longer just the skydiving operation? Are there more and more people who are actually opponents of the airport itself?
Well, it's hard to sometimes separate the two.
Sure.
The airport is has been there for years, and the people who live around it are more motivated right now to pay more attention because the skydiving activity has really increased the traffic there during the summer to dozens of flights a day, as opposed to maybe one dozen in a few years ago before skydiving was here. Now there are several dozen a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people would be happy if the airport went back to the way it was, and they wouldn't complain about the airport itself, but the whole thing has sort of got intertwined, and it's going to be interesting to hear what they have to say at the selectmen's meeting on Tuesday.
Understood. Lots of communities around the Cape have been telling their residents to look at these new proposed FEMA flood maps, and the Chatham Selectmen, I understand, you guys have reported they're getting involved too. They're protesting these maps?
Yeah, the selectmen have decided that they are not at all confident in the data that the new FEMA maps encapsulate, and they are writing a letter to FEMA to ask them to review this information. They're also going to support efforts that are underway in Boston and Washington to delay implementation of these new maps. Also on Tuesday this past week, they sort of took the Conservation Commission to task in town here for using those maps as a basis for reviewing projects rather than waiting until the maps were formally adopted, which is slated to happen in the spring. And the Conservation Commission said that they were doing this because they were advised by the state that this is the best information that's available now and that they should be relying on it. So there's a bit of a controversy there between those two groups. But the selectmen, I think they're resigned to the fact that there's going to be some changes to the flood maps. They would prefer that they be reviewed and that the information be as accurate as possible before so many more people are added to the floodplain and have to purchase flood insurance.
I understand that the deadline for making an appeal, like if your house is in a new flood zone,
yeah,
that the deadline is, I think, October 17th. And there's people that I believe at the Chatham Board of Selectmen, they were saying that there's people who don't even realize they're in these districts, let alone going to try and appeal whether their placement in there.
Sure. Where can people find out if they're in these districts?
They can go to their town hall. And I believe there's some, I'm not sure where the online version is, but I believe they're online as well. But I just want to say that also upset are the realtors. The Massachusetts Association of Realtors this week characterized this combination of, as kind of the combination of these maps and what these increased premiums, which can go as high as $20,000 a year, is going to do to the housing industry when we're finally seeing housing prices come back. And now, for example, one realtor said he has a home that he's listing for $325,000. The insurance on this house is going to be $20,000 a year.
Well, you have to wonder if the government's partially shut down, if there's anyone at FEMA to receive a letter from the Chatham Selectmen. Tim, the shutdown impacted the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge out there as well, right?
Yeah, the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge out on Morris Island is closed. The gate's up in front of the driveway. I was told by the officials there that they are not supposed to allow anyone onto the property at all, which is quite extensive, not only Monomoy Island, but the public trails and paths and beaches on Morris Island. It's kind of a squirrely thing, though, because there's no way that there's nobody out there really patrolling it because they're not supposed to be working. So it's a bit of an isolated area, and it's very easy to sort of get onto the property. When I was down there taking a picture the other day, there was a couple from New York who had come down, wanted to walk down along the shore, and they were told that they weren't supposed to go in through the gate. But the person who was there at the refuge said, "But you know, you can go down this way and walk onto the beach and get onto the refuge." So, I think the closure there is more of a formality than an actual experience. You know,
right. I mean, some folks, this is like the shoulder season, I guess,
right.
I mean, this is also one of the most beautiful times to be on the Cape and the islands, and people still come. You wonder, as this goes on, what's going to be the impact on our economy.
The other thing is, this last week was like summer. We had,
gorgeous.
You know,
yeah.
It was weather that was in the mid-70s, upper-70s, sunny days. There may have been people who wanted to just, they found a few days that they could just come and take a quick trip down here.
Right. So. Tim, thank you very much. Tim Woods, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Tim. Ann Brennan from the Cape Cod Times. Let's talk about mice on Nantucket or ticks on Nantucket. They're all kind of together. I mean, there's a nice circle of life there.
Right. Well, this revelation that apparently mice is the disease pool reservoir for not only Lyme disease, but also
anaplasmosis.
Thank you. And this is a study that's been going on for a few years. The scientists have been going down to Nantucket and stay during the summer. I mean, Martha's Vineyard, right?
No, Nantucket.
No, Nantucket. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the epicenter of the nation's tick problem right there on Nantucket.
I got lost for a few minutes. Sorry.
No, that's
but
okay.
They've been going down and spending pretty much like from May to October studying small mammals, including these white-footed mice. And they're also looking at these feeding stations that they've put up for deer. When the deer come to these feeding stations, they get powdered with pesticides to kill the deer ticks. Well, what they found was that they were surprised by the fact that these mice carry both these diseases. So attacking the tick is really not attacking the whole problem, because the tick gets the diseases from the mice and then jump on to people or deer. But the problem is you can't wipe out the mouse population because of they're an integral part of the food web on Nantucket. So they're, you know, further studies, but not really sure exactly what they're going to do, except that they are studying, like I said, these food stations in hopes that, and to see just how effective they are. They know that they are getting some of the ticks at these, you know, from these food stations, but how many and how effective, they're still looking into and trying to figure that out.
Right. These black-legged ticks, which are commonly called the deer ticks, because everyone blamed deer as the culprits behind Lyme disease, when now we're finding out these ticks are born without any disease at all. And they're tiny, tiny. And the first thing they typically bite are the little white-footed mice and the chipmunks and the squirrels. And that's, well, not so much with the squirrels, we're not quite as sure, but with the mice, they know they're getting the disease from them. And then they have two more meals left. And it's usually the third meal when they actually get on the deer. So those deer food stations, they've got these posts like paint rollers. So the deer stick their head in to eat corn, and they get that permethrin on their necks. And so that typically will kill those adult ticks. But you're right, it's the little young ticks. It's the first stage of life ticks that are ones picking up these diseases and passing them on. That anaplasmosis can kill you in days if it's not recognized. I mean, it causes internal bleeding.
Right.
So, they're learning more and more about ticks, and it's a major issue for us here on the Cape and the Islands, including Martha's Vineyard, of course.
Right. Well, and they said, you know, just recently, I remember being on recently, that they estimate that 300,000 people, not 30,000, have Lyme disease.
Right.
10 times more than they had originally suspected.
And it's a disease, Lyme disease is one that can be treated pretty well when caught right away. If it's not caught right away, you could find yourself in a lot of trouble, as folks here on the Cape have told pretty much all of us journalists about.
Right.
You know, I wanted to talk about the developer submitting a casino bid for the Wampanoag. Well, I guess we thought it was a casino the Wampanoag of Mashpee may get, but now there's some competition there, a private developer.
Right. This is KG Urban Enterprises that has made no secret that they want to build a casino in New Bedford.
Mm-hmm.
They have even sued in federal court, saying that the set aside for the one of the three state licenses that will be issued for an Indian tribe, which is the Mashpee Wampanoag at this point, if they get everything they need. But they sued, so we know they want interest. The suit is ongoing. But KG Urbine, at the last, on the deadline, I believe it was Wednesday, Monday, or Tuesday, earlier this week, they filed an application and paid the $400,000 to be, you know, by the deadline, to be considered for this, for the southeastern region. There's three regions. This is Region C.
Right. Well, let's review. Let's review where the tribe is right now.
Okay.
So they want to install a $500 million casino in Taunton, but they're dealing with the federal government before they can do that.
Right. So they have land that they have purchased, and they have petitioned to the federal government to get that land put into trust. It's only after that land is put into trust that they can build a casino on it. There's a glitch there that in 1934, the Supreme Court ruled that the government can no longer put land into trust for any tribe recognized after 1934. So the tribe is saying, we were under federal jurisdiction and we can prove it before 1934. So that question is still being resolved. The Congress hasn't acted to correct what they call the Carcieri decision. And so it's a wait and see. You know, we keep hearing from the tribe, this is going to be approved. It's going to be approved. In addition, the tribe and the state have to agree to a compact for what the tribe would pay this state in lieu of taxes. That their first agreement was, the legislature passed it, but the Bureau of Indian Affairs said, nope, the tribe is paying far too much money to the state, because in all likelihood there would also be a slot parlor in Region C. So the governor and the tribe have renegotiated a new compact that kind of has a sliding fee scale of taxes. taxes depending on what the competition is in Regency, and that is still at the legislature. It hasn't been passed yet, and that if it does get approved, would then have to go through BIA approval.
So these private commercial developers, they're looking at paying about 25% in taxes to the state. And their complaint is, well, the tribe would only have to pay, they're guessing, because it hasn't been approved by the federal government, as you say, 21% or less. So the private developers are upset by that. We may have more developers coming forward, because I understand from your reporting that the Gaming Commission will allow companies that didn't get a license in another area of the state to apply in southeastern Massachusetts, where you have the Wampanoag and now KG Urban Enterprises.
These are like Hard Rock Company, Claremont Companies. There's a couple that are saying, we're looking at partnering with another company and perhaps also putting a plan forward for Regency. So there could be even more competition. I think people are kind of waiting to see what happens with the Wampanoag and whether they get the federal approvals that they need. You know, KG Urban is going forward, but I think the other, and I think people are saying this shows that, you know, investors are not really crazy about putting their money out front at this point for this region because of the question of the Wampanoag getting through the federal process.
Right. We know that the state is supportive of the Wampanoag getting a casino, because if they're not involved in the process now and they are able to put things in trust later, they could just go out on their own and establish a casino and not pay any taxes to the state.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a wait and see. Very interested in that. We're going to take just a short break here. When we come back, we should be speaking with Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Nelson's going to talk about sharks. And welcome back to the News Roundup. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, or Managing Editor. Nelson, are you the Managing Editor or are you the editor?
I'm the Managing Editor.
All right. I just wanted to promote you there. Did you enjoy our...
I don't need any more.
That was our shark fishing music right there at the end. But we wonder if the Monster Shark Tournament is going to be continuing on Martha's Vineyard.
Well, it appears that it may not be. We learned from Peter Martell, the owner of the Wesley Hotel, that the shark tournament will not be returning in July. And he was in touch with Steve James, president of the Boston Big Game Fishing Club. And apparently Steve James told him that they wouldn't be returning.
And there was also there was some reporting in the story about the harbor master says they're usually reserving slips or something, and that hasn't happened?
Yes, the harbor master normally, right after the tournament, Steve James usually reserves slips for the coming year, and the harbor master said he had not heard from Steve James. Now, after this story was published, we did hear from Steve James. I received an email from him the other day. He said he'd have no comment. And I asked him to confirm he wouldn't be coming back to Oak Bluffs, and he said again to me he'd have no comment. But certainly he made some statements last July about Oak Bluffs and his view that he wasn't very welcome there. And he's the master of fiery rhetoric, so you know, how much of this is for a show, we don't know. But it does appear that, at least right now, they won't be returning, and that pleases some people, and other people are not so happy about it.
Is the frustration about the fact that the selectmen in Oak Bluffs have said, look, you've got some public safety issues here you got to pay for, is that primarily it, or is it a protest about hunting sharks at all?
No, Steve James is a big boy, and he's used to people complaining about the shark tournament, so I don't think it was that, but last year, the town of Oak Bluffs assessed an additional fee on the tournament to pay for what they said were the costs associated with extra police, ambulance, and other public services. And Steve James turned around and added a surcharge to the money that the boat owners pay, which is already pretty considerable when it comes to joining a shark tournament and everything it takes to run a very large fishing machine of the type that they use to go out for sharks. So he said it was unfair, and he said it he was going to look for a place where he might be more welcome. It's been in Oak Bluffs now for 27 years, so that's a pretty long time. A lot of people enjoy going down to the docks and seeing the very large sharks wade in. It's quite a spectacle, and depending on your point of view, it was a fun spectacle or a horrific spectacle.
Mm. And the word is that if they leave, they could be going over to Rhode Island.
Well, yes. There was some talk about going to Newport, also New Bedford. I mean, certainly the logistics would be easier in some respects, I suppose, for a tournament and for people who are taking part. Don't forget, in addition to the fishermen who come, often their family members, wives, come along. They stay in the port while the fishermen are out. I mean, shark fishing is not for the squeamish. I mean, you're going out often the. You're going out quite a distance, and you're spending a lot of time on the water. So it takes big boats. And...
Oh, I think we lost Nelson Siegelman there. He's on his cell phone. Yes, Ann.
Well, I just wanted to add that another thing that happens at this tournament, again, I'm not for or against it, but is the scientific research that some of the sharks, Craig Skolmal, for example, goes down, and they... you know, look at the sharks, take samples of the ones that have been killed, and do scientific research beyond, you know, the entertainment. That is another part.
Right. Well, it certainly has been controversial as well, and it's gotten bigger. The Discovery Channel has done some recording of the tournament as part of their Shark Week. And,
right.
I'm sure we can talk to Nelson about it again next week, and let's move on. Let's talk about wastewater here on Cape Cod. Boy. Let's see, if it's not wind, it's wastewater. If it's not wastewater, it's casinos. Go ahead. So what's going on? There was a group suing. There are two groups suing, I guess. The EPA, trying to force the EPA to make Cape Cod clean up its wastewater, and it's all about nitrogen.
Right. This is the Conservation Law Foundation out of Boston and the Buzzards Bay Coalition. They joined up on two lawsuits in federal court, like you said, that said the EPA has not been upholding the Clean Water Act law to get nitrogen out of and other nutrients out of the water on Cape Cod. This has been an issue down here because there's all this nitrogen loading from fertilizers, road runoff, septic systems, etc., are causing problems or deteriorating the water bodies of water around the Cape as well as marshes. And so they filed the suit. But a few months ago, the judge in the case ruled, dismissed all the claims except for one. And the judge at the time asked the two sides to get together and figure it out. And this involved a state water quality plan that has not been updated since 1978. So the CLF and the Buzzards Bay Coalition were contending that since it hasn't been updated, money that has been spent in the mass revolving fund for water quality projects has been capricious and arbitrary, because if you don't have a plan, how do you know where you're going, and is the money being spent effectively? That is the only thing that remains in this lawsuit. And this week, the Conservation Law Foundation filed a motion to withdraw itself from the remaining litigation.
The Buzzards Bay group withdrew.
Right, right? I'm sorry.
Not the Conservation
I'm
Law
sorry,
Foundation.
I apologize. The Buzzards Bay Coalition wanted to filed a motion to withdraw from the lawsuit.
So the Cape Cod Commission is still trying to put together this plan using money from that fund. And so the lawsuit now is only, what is the Cape Cod Commission actually doing with that money since there's no plan?
Exactly. And that was the point that the judge was trying to make in the case. He said, well, I know it hasn't been updated, but the Cape Cod Commission is working on this master plan for the Cape Cod area. So why don't you guys get together and work something out? And they couldn't. The Conservation Law Foundation still contends that currently, without an updated plan, this money is being they're not saying misspent, but they're saying arbitrary and capricious spending. And they think that the state should be held accountable for that.
And this legal tactic goes back to what happened with the Boston Harbor. I mean, it was a lawsuit that finally required the EPA to mandate the cleanup of the Boston Harbor.
Right. And that's been pretty successful, I have to say.
Yeah, I know. They got people swimming in it now.
Right. Well, the impact on the people who use the Mass Water Resources Authority water. That's the they were the ones that footed the bill for this. There was probably some federal money as well. I don't really remember.
Sure, it was a while ago.
But I do know that that the prices of water and water services went up. But in the end, you have a clean harbor, you have a resource, and but the problem is that when you have a lawsuit, you lose control. So the MWRA had to do this under the control of the court, rather than what the CAPE is worried about is if they lose local control of how to clean up this or solve this problem, that this, you know, the court judge could say, we want all these sewers, or we want, you know, there's no control over how much this is going to cost. And they would rather be able to have local control and use different types of measures to remove these nutrients from the water system.
Well, the numbers being bandied about are $3 to $8 billion to try to fix this problem on Cape Cod. That would be a significant tax hike. Well, that's the,
along with homeowners who would have to foot the bill for if they have to all of a sudden they have to attach to a sewer system.
You're right.
If that's what they use, if people on fixed income may not be able to make those payments.
Right.
So it's been a huge issue.
There's still a significant number of people who think that because you have a septic system, it's taking out the nitrogen as well, and that is definitely not the case. Quickly, let's hear about Senator Murray and some other senators. They're getting involved in this wastewater thing, trying to make it a little easier for communities to install whatever they need to install.
Well, this is a bill that Senator Murray announced earlier this week, or maybe yesterday even, that this would increase the caps on spending by the state on water pollution abatement in the state's Water Pollution Abatement Trust from $88 million to $138 million. It would also allow a sliding scale of interest rates for loans through the trust from 0 to 2% and establish other options to fund or reduce the cost of water infrastructure. So this would help communities. There would be more money available at a lower, you know, maybe even 0% interest that would help them, you know, improve the infrastructure where needed.
And so let's move on to a proposal in Dennis for a Lowe's Home Center there. And we can talk about that. It's been a recurring story here on the News Roundup. But I was interested. I was interested in Truro actually getting into the debate. The selectmen in Truro, who don't have a representative right now, an appointed representative to the Cape Cod Commission, they sent a letter. They referenced water quality when concerns about the installation of a Lowe's there. And not so much about traffic, but more about the character of Cape Cod. So is this debate kind of winding down? Where are we here? And when are they going to decide if the Lowe's is coming or not coming? And who's deciding?
Okay. Well, the decision is going to be by the Cape Cod Commission, and it's expected December 1st. And this is, because this is a development that would impact a large part of the Cape, that's why the Cape Cod Commission is involved. The public comment and public hearing period that had been going on for a few months was to end at 4 p.m. Wednesday. And in fact, our reporter called like around 3 and, you know, it looked like there wasn't any, you know, there were a few letters. And again, like you said, Truro had chimed in about wastewater issues. But later that, a few minutes or half hour later, the agency had received answers to questions that the commission had for the Lowe's folks, as well as a traffic improvement questions by a Dennis official on the planned traffic improvements along Route 134.
So late filings here.
Late filings. And because this is new information, they had to extend the comment period now for another week. So where it stands now is people can go and make comments on this new information that was submitted. In the case of Dennis, they're objecting to the Lowe's, including their parking lot, being contiguous with the parking lot for the Cape Cod Rail Trail. That parking lot for the rail trail is often congested as it is. And because the Lowe's is putting in for the minimum number of parking spots, that's why they need the rail trail. Mm-hmm. Dennis is saying, no, we want a hard fence there. We want to let, you know, keep those two things separate. And so we'll see what happens.
Sure. And, of course, some of the other reasoning against the plan would be that the Lowe's could unfairly compete with the locally owned businesses.
Exactly. Right?
And, of course, the letters page of the Cape Cod Times has had a lot of letters also in support of the project, saying some of this stuff we can't get around here. Some of it's more expensive. So it's been quite a contentious debate surrounding the potential arrival of a Lowe's home center.
Well, and the impact, like you say, on local businesses.
Sure, I think that's...
But the Lowe's is saying, we have so many people from Cape Cod who are going to our Wareham store.
Yep.
We think it's feasible to have it here. And the local businesses are saying, you're going to put us out of business.
Well, it's happened before with these types of things.
Right.
Let's talk about What. What is, of course, the Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater, a very well-known theater, a real gem here on the Cape, and there's some change, some turnover there.
Right. Well, the artistic director, Dan Lombardo, who has been in that position for the last 2 years, has resigned. He says he wants to spend more time with his family. His wife apparently works in the western part of the state.
Uh-huh.
And even though the What season is pretty much, you know, half the year, a little less, maybe 5 months, that he's there year-round. And he says the pace of this job is getting in the way of me being able to, you know, be with my family. And so he's decided that he's going to step down. In fact, it's the second company that, you know, theater company that has lost their artistic director. Cape Equity Theaters, I'm sorry. Evan Haley, his contract had ended last month with the Cape Playhouse in Dennis. But in the case of What, they're thinking it's going to take them some time to replace Lombardo, who, by the way, has been with What for about 9 years in different capacities. He became artistic director when Jeff Zinn stepped down. Zinn had been there for almost two decades. Hmm. So,
another story that we've spoken about here is related to a fight that had occurred at the Truro Harbor, and that was between, of course, an off-duty state trooper and and the harbor master. So the harbor master is now out of his job, and so now they're talking about maybe putting some cameras up at the harbor to keep track of what's going on there.
Right. The Truro Selectmen agreed this week to put two security cameras that record DVD at Pamet Harbor. This is a way to kind of protect one of the town's valuable public assets, as they call it. It's a public public and private property that is in that area. It's used a lot during the summer by fishermen, by boaters, you know, lots of traffic. And so they decided, because I know the fight was part of the reason they did this, they said, but it allows them to keep an eye on what's going on there. There was no, you know, maybe this whole situation with the fight that broke out they would have had more information about it had they had cameras rolling.
Right. Yeah, so they roll and record. It's not that they're going to assign somebody in public safety to monitor these things. They're just there in case an incident happens. They can go back and check the tape.
They already have them at the town, similar equipment at the town transfer station since 2011.
Well, here we are, 21st century. They're everywhere. Homicide charge for a driver in a crash. We don't do a lot of stories on car crashes. This was a significant crash in the Mid-Cape.
Benjamin Sheely in July was involved with a police chase that started in Harwich, ended in Chatham, with him allegedly hitting and killing a pedestrian and then crashing into a car with a family. Two 9-year-olds were in the back seat.
Right.
Both of those little girls were injured. He was indicted recently, which he had been originally arraigned in district court, but because it was district court level charges. Now he's been indicted. It's in Superior Court. It includes manslaughter by motor vehicle. He's pleaded not guilty. He's still being held.
So it's not a homicide charge, it's manslaughter charge?
Motor vehicle homicide. Both of them. And a dangerous hearing is set for this Tuesday, which is necessary to continue to keep him holding him without bail.
And he had
bail.
A long list of past offenses.
Exactly.
Well, I'm Sean Corcoran. That's what's happening here on Cape Cod. And so I want to thank my guests, Ann Brennan from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks for coming in to the Woods Hole studio. Tim Wood called in from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We also had Nelson Siegelman in, who called in from the Martha's Vineyard Times, though we lost him on his cell phone. Those things happen. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.